Welcome to episode 13 of Understanding Latin American Politics, the podcast. I'm Greg Weeks. I am a political scientist at UNC Charlotte. And today I am talking to Francisco Kiko Toro, who is executive editor at Caracas Chronicles, which is the go-to site for understanding Venezuela. And I figure that everybody who's listening either knows it or should know it. So thank you so much for taking some time.
Thanks.
So the Venezuela is funny because just looking at the headlines, at least in the U.S. press, but maybe also in Venezuela, is that we've got stories like there's a guy in Home Depot who's practically determining the value of the currency. We have the president of Venezuela threatening to sue J.P. Morgan, and we have the Venezuelan first nephews convicted of drug smuggling conspiracy in U.S. federal courts, which I just saw in Caracas Chronicles. I had not known the word narco sabrinos, and that's a great word. I love that word. But what we're not seeing is, okay, well, what's going on with the dialogue? What's going on with the opposition? And so I want to ask you, like, where do you see that standing right now? Is everything pushed in the background?
Well, okay, so to understand anything about the Venezuelan opposition, you need to begin to understand this radicals versus moderate split that there has been for a long time. There's one in the government and there's one in the opposition. And the key to understanding the dialogue dynamics right now is that the opposition moderates kind of outgun the radicals. They're more numerous. They have more power around the opposition table. And in the government, the radicals are more in control than the moderates. So you've ended up in this situation where the radicals in the government want a dialogue. They want to string it out for as long as possible because they don't want elections. They don't want any kind of referendum. They want to hang on to power for as long as they can. And the moderates in the opposition are also scared of a street confrontation. They don't want trouble in the streets. They think that's not going to be in their interest. So they're also interested in this dialogue, sort of for dialogue's sake, and they're willing to keep that going for as long as possible. So dialogue in Venezuela strangely worked out into a situation where the purpose of the dialogue is for there to be dialogue. Okay.
Yeah.
As long as there's dialogue, you're not going to have millions of people on the street. You're not going to have riots. You're not going to have the army getting up to hanky panky that they shouldn't be involved in. And in this strange way, the dominant sections of each of the parts in contention both want that.
So, I mean, does this work at all in terms of what the opposition actually wants to accomplish?
Well, it depends on what you think the opposition wants to accomplish.
Okay, well, back up then. What do you think? To the extent that we can talk about the opposition as an actual single thing, what is the goal?
Well, okay. So you have a section of the opposition that is more radical, that is more convinced that getting a change of government very quickly, probably this year or early next year, is absolutely necessary because the country is starving, because there are no medicines in the hospitals, because of all the reasons that people already know about. And so they have been pushing for an agenda that's much more confrontational, that's much more out on the streets, and that really is seeking to look at the army, at the military, and say, you have to make a choice. And this is an important choice, and you have to stand with the people, and you have to stand against this hyper-corrupt regime. But you have moderates in the opposition who are less concerned with the when of regime change and more concerned with the how. Mm-hmm. So you have guys like Primera Justicia, Un Nuevo Tiempo, most of Primera Justicia and Un Nuevo Tiempo, that take this attitude that if transition doesn't happen in an orderly and democratic and institutional way that is mediated through elections and where you have some level of buy-in from at least the moderate sections of the government, then you're going to have instability from now till kingdom come. All right. So they also don't agree on really on the ends. I mean, they both want to get rid of the government, of course, but there are these questions.
So you think is it fair to say that moderates then would be fine if this took 2-3 years?
Well, I don't think anybody.
The end of Maduro's term, let's say.
Look, nobody is fine with that insofar as these people have children, and those children are living in a country where a scraped knee can send you to a funeral parlor. So to call it fine would be an exaggeration. I think what I do think is that they're willing to countenance that the possibility that things can be worse. Things can be worse. So okay. You could layer onto that, layer onto all the economic and the political problems, a layer of civil war, really, of a violent strife between the government and the opposition, or a succession of failed governments that are like lasting a few months and then falling the way Ecuador and Bolivia used to be. So these people in the more moderate sections of the opposition think, look, if it's going to take 3 years to have a transition that's going to stick, that's worth waiting for.
Okay. And what do you think that dialogue can accomplish?
Pardon me. Look, in current circumstances, the only thing the dialogue is going to be able to accomplish is kicking the can down the road. Because dialogue doesn't really seem to be aimed at anything other than that. The government delegation is really top heavy with their most radical people, with people who really believe that it is right that opposition leaders be thrown in jail because they're fascists. People who are signed up to Fidel Castro's visions that elections are often dangerous because the people can make a mistake and can let reactionaries into power. People who really I don't trust to hold elections in 2018 at all. With those guys on the opposite side, I think the most you can get are some like small tactical concessions, like maybe having the elections board be run by less extreme pro-government people, maybe freeing a few, but not even that many political prisoners. Maybe elections in the contested southern seats of the National Assembly, which might allow the Assembly to have a little bit more power, those kinds of tactical things. But you are not going to get the serious concessions that I think we should be pushing for, such as no more political prisoners at all. This is not okay.
And what about holding a referendum? What do you think are the likely scenarios for that?
Well, certainly it won't happen before that critical deadline of January 10th next year. There's just no time. So there could be a referendum in 2017. Enrique Capriles, one of the more moderate party, Capriles is a radical inside a moderate party. He's been pushing for a referendum in 2017. And we hear that there is some backing for that inside parts of the more moderate bits of the ruling coalition. So that would leave the vice president, Maduro's vice president, in power until the end of his term. There's been some chatter about that, but what I'm really looking at is who the delegates, what the government delegation at the dialogue talks, it looks like. As long as it's top heavy with these very radical people, it's not going to happen.
And do you think that the opposition or the negotiators at this point have made too many concessions? I was curious about like agreeing that they were going to fight the economic war, combat it.
Yeah. You know,
sort of like what kind of statement is that making?
I was a bad blunder. Sadly, it now appears that the reason that look for me to hear opposition spokespeople adopt the government's propaganda language is deeply painful in a personal way, because I consider this, you know, as an activist, I consider this in a way a fight about truth and about what is true. And if you are going to give that away as part of negotiations, that you completely lose me as a constituency. I think they understand that it was a blunder. And sadly, what I'm hearing now is that they were pressured to use that kind of language and told that only if they agreed to that sort of language, would they get some political prisoners freed. But that has been that happened 2 weeks ago, and we've seen one political prisoner freed and not the most senior one.
Okay? Yeah, yeah. And it was startling to me, because I thought if you have a government that's been in power for 17 years, then probably you can safely say it's responsible for the economy.
Well, I mean, that's just plain obvious. I mean, part of what Chavista propaganda does is, because they control so many of the channels through which Venezuelans get information, TV, radio, internet, newspapers, all this stuff, and they have this capacity to just repeat, they use this repetition of these set phrases to create an atmosphere where things that are totally insane on their face come to look kind of reasonable. Like the idea, well, that, you know, possibly, you know, the opposition, which can't even stay out of jail, is somehow also running a giant, you know, plot to keep toilet paper off the shelves. It was really galling. And I tend to give the opposition quite a bit of slack. The moderates in the opposition, I tended to give them quite a bit of slack until I saw that press release. That's where I got off the bus.
Trying to think just realistically, and you maybe were sort of getting this to this already. What are the alternatives to dialogue or what the strategy is right now? Are there real alternatives that aren't just civil war?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think the opposition really should look at civil resistance, should look at nonviolent resistance in a serious way, in a way that it hasn't done before. That takes a lot of training, that takes a lot of preparation, but it also takes a kind of nonviolent but confrontational attitude towards the government, of looking at them, staring them down, and saying, no, this is not okay, and we will not agree to cooperate to give legitimacy to a series of insanities that you're trying to put into the public sphere. So I think we should be on the streets much more. I think what's sad about the dialogue is that the government went into dialogue understanding it as a way to demobilize, to divide, to demoralize the opposition, and it's worked. It's worked that way. So I think you know, if you look at, you know, I've been reading the letter from a Birmingham jail from Martin Luther King Jr. If you look at that, he tells you, yes, the purpose of nonviolent resistance is to bring the other side to the negotiating table, but to bring them, to make them the demander, to make them the ones who are in pain and who need negotiations because they need you to stand down. So negotiations need to come at the end of a campaign of disobedience. And we are skipping past the disobedience and going to negotiations in the situation where we don't have anything to negotiate with, and so we make concessions, and they promise concessions, don't make them, and then we make more concessions. It's bad.
How would you say the Venezuelan people themselves fall on this? So you have Chavistas, you have the opposition, you have kind of the ninis. You know, how do you think this is playing out in their minds, and what do they hope will happen?
What public opinion research is showing us is that there are very large majorities for a change of government very soon, as soon as this year, as long as it's done peacefully. Majorities that sort of wither away and die very quickly as the second you think that there's going to be disorder on the streets.
Okay.
All right? So this is, you know, Venezuela is not a 50-50 country anymore. If you ask, you know, even Chavistas understand that the government is hopelessly inadequate to the task of running the government. So you get, in the last referendum, like recall referendum question that I saw polled, it was running 8-1. All right. Okay. So 88% to 11% wanted to recall Maduro. But of course the government understands that's why they're not having, the government understands that, and that's why they're not having a referendum. That should be clear.
Right.
But it's also true that the government understands that when you start to ask people, you know, are you willing to go out into the streets and face down a bunch of soldiers? No, of course they're not. People like massively don't want to do that. People get scared. So the government understands that keeping this threat of force and this threat of violence hanging in the air over any opposition activity is kind of a winning proposition from their point of view, because the majority is in favor of regime change. And the second that comes up.
Okay. How does the economic collapse play into this? I mean, what we're hearing is dire. You know, and so how does that affect dialogue, or does it, how does that affect the way that Venezuelans will respond to, protests? You know, how does that play into it?
Well, it's hard for people who are often not eating three times a day to take a day off work to go protest. That's very clear, because you need that day's earnings to eat and possibly not even quite get your fill that day. So in that sense, it's demobilizing. We haven't reached the kind of tipping point where people think, well, I'm just going to starve anyway if I don't protest, so I better, you know, balance the probabilities better to go out and protest in any case. The government has established a situation now where it's understood that they will arrest and intimidate and rough up protesters. And that's understood widely enough that it's hard to get a critical mass of people out in the streets. You know, people feel safe protesting if they're protesting side by side with a lot of other people, because there's safety in numbers. But the government has managed to create this climate of fear where it's difficult to protest, and then there's this economic considerations layer on top of that makes it hard to get people out into the streets. But what can I tell you? It's really desperate. I think the government is leveraging their indifference to people suffering at the negotiating table, because they very clearly shun. Now, Lilian Tintori, Leopoldo López's wife, so this jailed opposition leader's wife, who is an activist, managed to get together this operation to bring medical supplies from Venezuelans living abroad to hospitals that literally don't have gauze and that don't have aspirin and don't have antibiotics. She got all these donations ready to bring them into the country, and the government physically prevents her from delivering these drugs to children in children's hospitals, considering that kind of delivery an attempt to destabilize the government. So by the time you've reached that point where you're willing to say, no, children in a children's hospital have to die for lack of antibiotics because I'm not going to give tactical political points to an opponent, you can see the way that simply not caring what happens to people becomes a tactical advantage for these guys at the negotiating tables. How do you negotiate with people who care that little? It's hard.
Yeah, and you said tipping point. I mean, the economic crisis has been going on for a while. Is there any sign that people would be hitting that kind of a tipping point?
Well, I think that the way these are dynamically unstable processes, right? You know, they're chaotic processes. The tipping points are not visible ahead of time. So I don't think there's a leading indicator of when this is going to happen. We know the economists that I talk to are really freaked out about what's happening to monetary aggregates and liquidity in the last few weeks, because it's been growing at a pace that would suggest that we're sort of moving from high persistent inflation into hyperinflationary territory. Now, we've had 700% inflation. We haven't had like 3,000 or 10,000% inflation.
Yeah.
And that shift, you know, bad as 700% inflation is, that shift into inflation where with things, you know, doubling in price every few days or getting to a sort of Bolivia or Argentina in the 80s territory, that's something Venezuela has never experienced in its history. That's never happened in Venezuela. So historically, it's clear that very few governments survive episodes of hyperinflation, and money is now being created because the government nobody will lend money to the government for obvious reasons, and so they're printing up the extra money they need to meet their spending needs. We could be moving into hyperinflationary territory in the next few months. Is that a tipping point? We'll find out when it happens.
And so thinking of this state of economic collapse, I'm reminded of the famous image of the orchestra playing on the Titanic. But what do people think of Maduro going on radio, going on TV, and dancing salsa while talking? Does that seem it's almost too bizarre to believe it's real? It's like the Onion.
I wish I had something insightful to say about that. It makes just as little sense to me as it does to you.
Okay. And at this point, do Venezuelans just say, okay, well, that's just kind of what he does?
It's hard to know. I think okay. different people will have different reactions to this. I can't help you here.
Okay. Switching gears just a little bit, in the U.S., there's always pushes to have some kind of a response to the Maduro government, usually punitive. Now we actually have a pretty radical shift of government in the U.S. What do you think? Well, sort of two questions. What do you think is the optimal response by the U.S. government to what's going on in Venezuela? And what do you think is going to happen potentially with a Trump presidency?
Well, the first part is relatively easier. I think the U.S. government needs to be building bridges and setting up golden parachutes so that people who are scared to give up power, give up power. And I think indicting them and threatening them is not the way to do that. So I think that in that sense, I think U.S. policy has been counterproductive under Obama. I think it would make much more sense to be quietly talking to your guys in Costa Rica or whichever country it is that takes, washed up old dictators these days and setting up, cajitas felices for these guys. Now the other question is much trickier. On the one hand, because of course we don't know anything about what Donald Trump is going to do because Donald Trump doesn't know anything about what Donald Trump is going to do.
Fair enough.
On the one hand, we know that there are a lot of Russian interests in Venezuela these days, and Trump seems to have this very peculiar relationship with the Russians. I mean, and Trump also doesn't seem interested in democracy promotion in any way. So would it be surprising to have Venezuela be sort of carved out of the Monroe Doctrine and de facto ceded to the Russians as part of, the Russian embassy, the Russian sphere of influence's embassy in Latin America? I think that's imaginable. And the Russians certainly want to get paid for the loans that they've made. On the other hand, we have seen, and remember a couple of years ago when some of the first sanctions against regime officials came down, Maduro ran this big campaign to basically troll President Obama and to say, Obama, derroga el decreto, Obama, take back your executive order, and attacks on state media day in and day out and really goading and insults and these kinds of things. Can you imagine Donald Trump on the receiving end of that?
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, he's going to flip out. I just have this image in my head of the people in the Latin American desk at the State Department, the Venezuela desk, trying to figure out how to like shield it so the president doesn't find out, because if he does, he's going to flip out.
Now, essentially, you're critical of, or saying the Obama administration could be counterproductive. He sent Tom Shannon there a bunch of times. Do you not think that had anything to do with sort of at least hinting at golden parachutes, or what's even the purpose of that then?
Look, from what we've been able to see, Tom Shannon's been going to Venezuela to keep this dialogue process going. And this dialogue process is meant to keep Venezuela stable. Stability becomes sort of the key word, but then stability ends up becoming code for something else. And that code is convivir en paz. It's sort of making your peace with the fact that, well, you are now a dictatorship and you live under a dictatorship and you're going to have to deal with that for like the foreseeable future. And please don't wreck the entire country as you try to get rid of that dictatorship. I mean, that is a line that I consider, counterproductive. I think it would make much more sense to say, no, confront these guys on the streets. Disobey them, show them that they will not have your obedience, and at the same time show them that while they will not have your obedience at home, that they have options if they leave. That seems to me like a more coherent policy. Because what Shannon and Obama are doing, they're creating many, many reasons for these guys not to leave.
Okay, so all they're doing is help to kick the can down the road.
Because they want stability, because they don't want refugee flows out of Venezuela, because they don't want Venezuela to destabilize an iffy Colombia or a Cuba. They have like more hemispheric concerns in mind. And they also, I think, probably just don't think the Venezuelan opposition is up to running the country democratically. So why would you destabilize the country to put a bunch of no-hopers in charge of it?
Right. One other quick, very quick question, just because you had done a mini tweet storm about the question of whether Donald Trump was like Hugo Chavez, because I'd had Tim Gill who said no.
Right.
So for you, the answer is yes.
Right. I mean, I think the thing that bothered me about your previous interviews is the sense that, you know, Trump is right wing and Chavez was left wing, and therefore, you know, QED, that's the end of that discussion. I think it's a really thin way to look at it. I think what we see in Trump and what we saw in Chavez was contempt for institutions, contempt for the rule of law, and contempt for the sort of the soft institutions, the unspoken traditions of how things are run, that are actually the things that keep a political system stable and an uneven keel and ultimately democratic and under the rule of law. So I think while programmatically they're obviously very, very different, I think this type of contempt for the input of experts and for institutions is deeply destabilizing in the medium term.
Yeah, and I got the impression just from in the press reading from the opposition leaders who were commenting after the election, it was sort of like, oh, well, you're screwed.
You know, election, the American election night here, I huddled together with some other Venezuelan expats, and there were very few words spoken because very few words needed to be spoken. The sense of deja vu for those of us who lived 1998 and Chavez's first election was so palpable. Yeah. And a lot of the discussions, you know, the discussions, well, how are they going to manage him? Now he's in power, you know, how are they going to, like, build a cordon sanitaire so his craziness doesn't, like, wreck the country? Like, these are discussions that we had, and that looking back on them, we just look back and think, God, we were so deluded to think that you could manage, like, a malignant narcissist in power. You can't.
All right.
I'm sorry, guys.
On that high note, we are out of time. I've been talking to Francisco Kiko Toro, who is executive editor at Caracas Chronicles, and also check him out on Twitter. I don't have your Twitter feed right in front of me.
At Kiko Toro, okay. Q-U-I-C-O Toro.
All right. Kiko, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, Greg.